Hello and welcome to another episode of the Richards Report. I'm Ted Richards. This episode, we're zooming into a growing new industry. Some call it alternative meat or alternative protein. I've even heard it described as meatless meat. Doesn't matter what you call it, it's a very interesting space right now, and I'm speaking with one of the co-founders of a new Australian producer, speaking with the CEO of Fable Food Company. I'm fascinated by disruption and innovation. Previous guests of the show have spoken about how they're innovating in their industries, and at Fable, they're kind of disrupting the steak and three veg meal. Now, you don't need to be a vegetarian to find this interesting. I want to be upfront here, as I love meat. My mum and dad live on a farm with cattle and sheep on it. My wife's family are farmers in Henty. Shout out to Henty. Occasionally, after a few drinks, I don't even mind a bit of Dirty Bird or Macca's. But on the other hand, I can also see the many benefits for myself and the planet from reducing the amount of meat that I eat. A word that I've recently come across, which possibly describes this new type of consumer, is a flexitarian. Maybe this flexitarian term also describes how you think about the food you eat too. Before we jump into the discussion, this is my 40th episode, so thanks to everyone that has been on the journey with me. It all started about 3 years ago, and I continue to be amazed of the power of podcasts. And thank you to those that have provided feedback or ratings and listened in. If this is the first episode that you've listened into, welcome. Make sure you click the subscribe button and check out the back catalogue. And if this isn't your first episode, then welcome back and thanks for listening in again. Please spread the word. Maybe even send this episode to a flexitarian you might know. As always, the usual disclosures, this podcast is just for educational purposes only and does not qualify as financial advice, and people may hold positions in the companies discussed. And show notes will be available on the Six Park website, sixpark.com.au, sixpark.com.au. With no further ado, my name is Ted Richards. You're listening to The Richards Report, and here is my discussion with co-founder and CEO of Fable Foods, Michael Fox.
You're listening to The Richards Report, where we will speak with investment experts from around the country. We will cut through the jargon to allow you to make more insightful investment decisions for your future. This is The Richards Report.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for joining me on The Richards Report.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me.
Now, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you actually listen into the show?
Yeah, I do. I've listened to quite a few of your podcasts. Nick Crocker's one of our investors, so I listened to that episode, and I was catching up on some of your episodes the other day and listened to the one, I've forgotten the name now, but the psychologist you were chatting to early on in COVID.
Alan
about
Jackson.
How to sort of deal with. Yeah, that was a really good one too.
Thanks. I love it. That's great for my ego. And so take that, Joe Rogan. Before we jump straight into Fable and what you're doing right now, I want to step back a bit and touch on a previous venture you were involved in with Shoes of Prey. And for those not familiar with this business, can you tell us a bit about Shoes of Prey?
Yeah, so the concept was women could design their own shoes online. So you could come to our website and it was kind of women's fashion shoes. So you could choose kind of your heel height, type of shoe, toe shape, different leathers, colors, materials. You designed your shoes online and then we manufactured them and delivered them to you. And we did that online, and then we did some partnerships with David Jones and Nordstrom in the US.
I think you're kind of underselling this business. Like how big was it at one stage?
So we did, I'll kind of take you through the journey. So we did really well initially in this niche of women who are very passionate about designing their own shoes. But we had all these mass market consumers coming to the website, but they weren't buying. We had decent, really good sales in this niche, and overall sales were good, but conversion rates were low because we had all these mass market consumers coming to the website. So we went and did a bunch of consumer research, talked to these customers. And what this customer told us was that she loved the idea of designing her own shoes, but she wanted faster lead times. At the time, it was about a 5-week turnaround. She wanted sub 2 weeks. She wanted a much more simplified shoe design experience, and she didn't want to pay the 30% premium we were charging for designing her own shoes. So we looked looked at that and we said, well, yeah, we can deliver those things. But to do that, we're going to need to build our own. At the time, we were using an external manufacturer. So we wasn't really going to be able to scale up and speed up delivery times and bring down unit costs. So we said, yeah, well, we can do that. We're going to have to build our own shoe factory and we're going to need to hire more user experience and software engineering people to simplify the shoe design experience. So up until that point, we hadn't raised any capital. We'd just grown the business out of its own cash flow. But yeah, to make that investment to go after the mass market, we went out and raised some venture funding. And then over the next 5 years, we did four rounds of venture funding and ended up raising $35 million Australian dollars across the four rounds. Some Australian VCs like Blackbird Ventures, where Nick Crocker works, and Mike Cannon Brooks with Grok Ventures, and then some US VCs invested in the later rounds. And we used that capital to build out our own manufacturing facility in China. The team sort of grew to about 200 people. We moved our headquarters from Sydney to Los Angeles because the US had become our biggest market. We did a distribution deal with Nordstrom, so you could go into Nordstrom shoes and design shoes on iPads on the women's shoe floors in Nordstrom. And over that 5 years, we grew from sort of a 2 million revenue run rate to about a 10 million revenue run rate. So, you know, 5x growth over the 5 years. But that wasn't what we should have grown much more than that if the value proposition was resonating with that mass market customer. And we needed to grow more than that because we'd raised all this capital. We had all these fixed costs now of running our own shoe factory and big software engineering team. We needed to be at kind of a 25, 30 million revenue run rate to be breaking even. And we should have been at like 100 million revenue if the value proposition was resonating. So now we'd built the value proposition, we could look at how consumers were behaving and in not designing their own shoes, or not as many of them as should have been. And what we realized was basically we'd got our market research wrong. The mass market consumer, when you talk to her, and consciously she thinks she wants to customize. So if you ask her, if you do surveys and focus groups, she'll tell you that she wants to design her own shoes because she thinks she does. But deep down subconsciously, she doesn't really have the confidence to do it. And she really just wants to see what's popular in fashion magazines and on Instagram and buy not only that design, but even buy that brand. And that's in her subconscious. So she can't necessarily express that. And your subconscious is more powerful than your conscious mind. So yeah, the mass market consumer just wasn't buying, even though our market research had told us when she'd said that she would. The value proposition that we created just wasn't resonating with that consumer.
It's quite interesting, the paradox of choice, I think they call it, in that from an investment point of view, when it comes to people choosing superannuation fund, there's 50 out there, there's possibly hundreds. It's very hard for someone to choose the fund that is appropriate for them. And there is a belief that they should strip that back to a handful of choices to make it an easy choice. And it's also part of the reason why it can be hard to pick a pasta sauce at the supermarket when there's 20 different types of tomato sauce. Out of interest, before we move on from Shoes of Prey, approximately how many shoes were you selling?
Yeah, so we're on about a 10 or 12 million revenue run rate in Australian dollars, and at about average kind of $200 a pair. So my head calculator is not quite good enough, but I think roughly it might have been like 150, 200 pairs a day we were sort of doing at the peak, and they were all kind of one-off pairs of shoes individually designed. So we kind of developed all these manufacturing, really unique IP and the manufacturing processes that we developed. And we had this amazing like just-in-time inventory system. Like the model was just built around that. So we didn't hold stock. We had a positive cash flow cycle because customers paid us up front and then we made the shoes. So there were lots of really attractive things about the business, except that the value proposition just didn't resonate with the mass market consumer. So ultimately we ended up closing the business down. And it was kind of 10-year journey. I took a lot of lessons out of all that.
We could have a whole episode on Shoes of Prey. I think it's fascinating, but I do want to speak about what you're up to right now. So let's move from disruption and innovation in retail to disruption and innovation in food and move on to Fable. I came across you guys, Fable, when I was doing a mushroom forage in the Macedon Ranges in Victoria with one of your co-founders, Jim Fuller, who I believe is your chief science officer.
Yep.
And these are the things that you do on the weekend when there's no football. and I noticed some of the clothes that Jim was wearing. I believe it was a hat that said Fable and a t-shirt that said Fable, that which sparked a curiosity in me. And then for those that might be watching on YouTube can actually see you've got some of the similar merch on right now. There's a few alternative meat providers out there, and most of which are going down the path of producing burgers. Can you tell us a bit about Fable and how you compare to others?
Yeah, so maybe it'll help frame that story up. I'll tell the kind of journey of how we started the business. So, I'll tell it from my angle first, and then my co-founders Jim and Chris. So, for me personally, I went vegetarian 4.5 years ago. For me, kind of a mix of health, environmental, and ethical reasons. I was doing Shoes of Prey full time, so it wasn't anything outside of just a personal decision. Then, when I finished up with Shoes of Prey, I took 6 months off. My wife's Danish, so we went over to Denmark, and my daughter was born over there, and it just had time out being a parent, and also just had time on my hands for the first time in a decade, and ended up reading about wherever my intellectual curiosity took me. And one of those areas was meat alternative space and industrial animal agriculture. And yeah, I just got very passionate about the idea of wanting to help contribute to reducing our reliance as a society on industrial animal agriculture, for all the same reasons I'd gone vegetarian. You know, it's eating as much meat as we do isn't good for us. It's not good for the environment, and the treatment of animals isn't great. So wanted to start a meat, ended up getting to the point of wanting to start a meat alternative company. Was thinking through what kind of meat alternative I'd want to create. And for me, I'm a pretty healthy eater. Moved back to Australia, living on the Sunshine Coast. I shop at my local farmer's markets in Kawana here, and yeah, do a lot of my own cooking at home, bake my own sourdough, brew my own kombucha. And for me, I wanted a really kind of minimally processed whole food based meat alternative. And so, you know, even though I'm vegetarian, I still crave meat. Like, I walk past a cafe and they're cooking bacon and egg burgers, and you know, those are the points in time when it's hard being vegetarian. So I still kind of want to eat all those sort of meaty, delicious foods. So yeah, started exploring, is it possible to create a really whole food, healthy, all natural meat alternative? Not coming from food myself, I went and talked to a whole bunch of chefs and people in the industry, and got put onto the idea of potentially using mushrooms as a base ingredient. Mushrooms are obviously really good for you. They've got a lot of those kind of meaty, umami flavors in them. And then through exploring the mushroom space, I met Jim and Chris, who are my co-founders. And yeah, as you've seen, meeting Jim on that foraging tour, incredibly passionate and knowledgeable about mushrooms. I think both Jim and Chris live and breathe everything about mushrooms. So yeah, Jim grew up in Texas, chef for 10 years, wanted to understand the science behind what he was cooking. So he went and studied chemical engineering and agricultural science. He majored in mycology, which is mushroom science, and he's worked as a mushroom scientist for the last 12 years. It's a really unique, weird skill set of a chef and a mushroom scientist in one human being.
I couldn't imagine a more perfect co-founder in this space.
Totally. And then Chris complements it out really well too. So Chris McLaughlin, co-founded Australia's largest organic mushroom farm. He was Organic Farmer of the Year in Australia in 2018 and Young Farmer of the Year in 2018. So yeah, between Chris and Jim, they know everything there is to know about growing mushrooms, the science behind mushrooms, and how to cook mushrooms. And they'd been on a similar journey to me separately, and they'd started actually developing some mushroom-based meat alternatives. So we met, we had about five people tell us, hang on, you guys all need to meet. Like, yeah, Michael, you're exploring mushroom-based meat alternatives. Jim and Chris are too. So we actually caught up down in Melbourne for coffee. We weren't sure if we were going to be like friends or competitors before we'd met. Yeah. So we teed up a coffee at, I think it was like 3 p.m. at a coffee shop. And we'd all agreed to keep our calendars free that afternoon and evening, so that if the coffee went well, we could chat more and hang out. And if not, we'd just call it a day after coffee. And yeah, it went really well. Got on like a house on fire. You've met Jim. Really lovely guy. And same with Chris. And so, yeah, we've got really complementary skill sets. They come with a strong technical background. Chris is a mix of the business and the technical side, and then I've got the kind of entrepreneurial background. So kind of joined forces to develop mushroom-based meat alternatives.
There's so many different ways I can go from here, but let's start off with the product. in that, and I mean this respectfully, it's not mush. It's like you've got some tendon structure there and it's kind of seared and you're using shiitake mushrooms. Can you tell us a bit about how you got to that stage in the market research?
Yeah. So Jim grew up in Texas, eating all those, and as a chef, cooking all those kind of slow cooked meats like braised beef, beef brisket, pulled pork. When we were doing our market research, I was like kept up at night. You know, we'd got our market research wrong in Shoes of Prey. So I was like adamant that we were going to make sure that we got that right this time around. So I spent a lot of time just in supermarkets, watching how consumers, the challenge with Shoes of Prey is the value proposition didn't exist for designing your own women's fashion shoes. So the only thing we could do was ask consumers, that we couldn't watch how they behaved. So this time around for Fable, there are other meat alternatives on the market. So I've spent a lot of time actually watching how consumers behave in the category, not just asking them. So I spent a lot of time in Coles and Woolies, just watching consumers shop the meat alternative bay, seeing what they picked up and didn't buy, seeing what they picked up and did put in their shopping trolley, and then going and creepily asking them about what they'd purchased and or put down, and asking them why they'd made those decisions.
And how was that well received?
I had a lot of very interesting conversations. Some people a bit freaked out, but mostly actually really, really open to chatting. It was actually quite a fun experience. I still go and do it from time to time. It's interesting what people share. And out of that market research, two big things came out. One was matched with my own buying behavior as a consumer in the category, people wanting really healthy, minimally processed, all natural meat alternatives. And then the second thing that came out of it was, as you touched on, there's a lot of burger patties and beef mince alternatives, but people wanted other types of meat. You know, there's lots of other types of meat that they're trying to sub out of their diet. So that combined with that research, combined with Jim's passion for slow cooked meats, meant that we went down the path of developing kind of slow cooked meats first.
I actually found it fascinating how much it actually tastes like meat. Did you do any blind tests?
Yeah, we've done a lot of that actually, because our target consumer is kind of not the vegan or the vegetarian. Obviously, it's great if vegans and vegetarians buy the product, but you know, our mission, we want to help people reduce their meat consumption, so that we've got to target meat eaters. It's people who love the taste and texture of meat, but want to reduce their meat consumption for health or environmental or ethical reasons. So key thing for us in the value proposition for that consumer is the taste and texture of meat. So we didn't want this to be a falafel ball or a hemp seed patty or taste like mushrooms. We wanted to have it taste like meat so that you could sub it out. So yeah, during our product development phase, we did a lot of blind testing, and probably the moment when we realized, felt like we'd properly nailed it. Actually, there are a couple of moments, but probably the best one was we served it up at a lunch. A chef made a Fable lasagna, served it up to 60 people at lunch, and just not telling them what it was, just serving up a lasagna. And not a single person out of the 60 people guessed that it wasn't meat until we told them afterwards. That kind of blind testing was a key part of our product development.
What a win there. When I was thinking about this discussion, I realized that Fable and I have actually got a bit in common in that you hide vegetables to make it look like and taste like something else. And I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and I spent a lot of time trying to hide vegetables in food for them. And whilst that's a bit, hopefully that's not disrespectful, and hope it's a bit tongue in cheek, but I want to speak about the fact that we do actually taste a lot with our eyes. And for when I was doing some research and I was looking at your product, I noticed it's very different to others' complementary products out there, be it tofu, tempeh, falafel balls. And with your packaging too, it's got like a different look and feel to the usual products in that it's very cool. And I'm guessing this wasn't an accident.
Yeah. And I've got a 3.5 and 1.5-year-old, so I'm with you on trying to hide vegetables and get more of that into their diets. So our kind of go-to-market strategy, our thought process was we wanted to, first of all, go into food service to build the brand. So have consumers actually try the product with a chef cooking it up for them, and then meet the brand, you know, have the brand on the menu in those places. And so taking a step back from that, we thought the best place to start would be to, if we can have a, you know, really good chef using the product and have that sort of as our launch pad. So we wrote out a list of top chefs, and Heston Blumenthal was number one on the list. And conveniently, Jim and Chris had actually met Heston a few years ago as he'd been starting to explore the mushroom space. So they took some product for Heston to try middle of last year. He loved the product so much so that he started using, he was actually our first restaurants to use it were his restaurants in the UK. That was kind of an amazing experience for us. Just learning from Heston too. He gave us some great feedback on the product, how to develop a couple of development changes and how to pitch it into chefs to use in their restaurants. In doing that, we wanted to make it as easy as possible for both chefs and people cooking at home to take their kind of existing meat recipes and sub in the meat for our product. A key part of what we're doing was replicating as much as we can around the experience of eating meat. So the taste and texture, the way it cooks, how you can use it in your, the kinds of recipes that you can use it in. Really it's designed to replace braised beef, beef brisket, pulled pork, anywhere that you'd use those meats. So it works really well as like a beef brisket or pulled pork burger, amazing in tacos, really good in like steak pies, curries, meatball bolognese's, all those sorts of dishes. And then Heston went and did some whacked out things. We did our launch event at Dinner by Heston in Melbourne. He's got he replaced snails in a dish with Fable. So we hadn't really figured it as a snail alternative.
Very niche.
Yeah, very niche. And then he did this Vegemite ice cream dish. And so he caramelized some of it up and put it in a dessert. That's Heston for you.
We might come back to him later on in the discussion. For now, I just want to touch on luck, as we all need a bit of luck in life. Jim Collins, who I'll call a friend of the show, talks about how great companies get a better return on luck. I think he calls it who luck, something like that. Anyway, what I want to talk about here is, when did you officially launch Fable? When did it officially come out?
So December was our kind of launch event, yeah.
Okay, so December 2019. And there's a few things I want to talk to there, one of which is, and then a Netflix series comes out called Game Changers.
Yeah.
Has that helped you?
Without a doubt.
Before we get into the discussion, for those not familiar, Game Changers is a documentary on Netflix which talks about the benefits of a plant-based diet. And I watched it with my wife, and I love my meat. I love all sorts of meat, but it made me think. So, tell me about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a bunch of really good academic data on the health benefits of a plant-based diet. It's pretty pretty clear that we shouldn't be eating the 110 kilograms of meat that we eat in Australia every year. You know, maybe there's a case for some moderation and eating maybe 20 kilograms of meat per person per year. But there's also a very good case for just not eating any meat. And it's all been in kind of academic literature, but Game Changers was like just a really well done documentary, taking all of that academic literature and turning it into something that's, you know, much more easy to consume than an academic article. Super popular documentary. A lot of people watch that. And that and a whole bunch of other kind of books and documentaries is kind of raising general consumer awareness of particularly the health benefits of a plant-based diet. And so that's what's helping drive growth in this category. Survey data says that about 30% of Australians actively want to reduce their meat consumption, but still love the taste and texture of meat. And so that's kind of that kind of flexitarian customer, they're called, that's kind of who we're going after.
It's a new term that I wasn't aware of. And I think I'm probably someone that fits in that flexitarian market. When I watched that documentary, I thought I'd go to Hungry Jack's and give the Impossible Burger a bit of a go. And I was actually surprised I thought they'd given me a meat burger, In that it looked and tasted like a meat burger. I don't know if it's any healthier because I think it's got a fair bit of fat in it. I do want to speak about the ingredients in yours. It's incredible. You've only got, 7 ingredients? But I was actually thinking from an IP point of view, is that a negative that there's only 7 ingredients? Like, is there any IP here?
Yeah. So yeah, it's 7 ingredients plus salt and pepper. So we've kind of actively kept it, really short, clean ingredient list. It's all things that you would cook with out of your pantry. We wanted to goes back to that kind of whole food, all natural, minimally processed diet. It's a good question around IP. And it's kind of a challenging thing when you want to produce something that's really whole food based and minimally processed. You're actively trying to do as little to the base ingredients as possible to make it better for customers. I think the IP kind of moats for us, there is actually a lot of science in what we're doing, particularly in some of the cooking steps for the product. So we've got some provisional patents on a couple of those cooking steps for the base product. And also just the understanding of how to cook the shiitake mushrooms to kind of tone down the mushroom flavors and amplify the meat flavors. And that comes from Jim's mushroom science coupled with chef background. He's got those skill sets. So some of the patents will help us there in those manufacturing processes. And then the other big piece for us is kind of building the brand. So yeah, your question kind of touched on that earlier around wanting to build something a brand that is kind of got Heston on our packaging in Woolworths. We've gone with a really sort of clean look for the packaging, premium positioning. The recipes that we show are very sort of meaty and delicious, and we don't kind of shy away from Jim's Texan barbecue background. That's kind of we want to celebrate that in all of what the brand's about, as well as mushrooms. Like, I think there's this trend. There's a big trend in meat alternatives. There's this, I think, slowly building trend in mushrooms, and that's kind of coming from people just starting to discover all the health benefits of mushrooms. And they're just such an interesting, amazing, there's the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, and the fungi kingdom. There's more species of mushrooms than there are plants. They're incredibly regenerative in sort of when they're used in agricultural practices. You came on that foraging tour. It's kind of fun to go out foraging for mushrooms. And so we want to kind of bring all of that into the brand as well. I think our two kind of key areas of IP that we're building are in the product development and in the brand.
Well, I was just, as you were talking there, thinking about something that I also buy that probably doesn't have that many other ingredients, but I won't consider another brand, and it's Vegemite, which I'm pretty sure is just yeast extract plus one or two other things. And I buy Vegemite because I like it, and I don't like Marmite and the others out there. But you mentioned shiitake, like shiitake mushrooms. It would have been so much cheaper, I'm sure, to use like your humble white button mushroom. Why is shiitake mushrooms important? Because I'm assuming they're probably more of an expensive mushroom to use.
So the benefit of shiitake mushrooms, so they're a very slow growing mushroom, and they grow on logs, which does make them a little more expensive to produce. But that slow growing process means that they're a little bit firmer than other species of mushroom. And so basically we take the shiitake mushroom, we shred it, and that gives you those kind of, as you touched on earlier, those kind of the tendons, sinewy sort of pieces of the slow cooked meat. And then we mix in the other all natural plant-based ingredients into the product. And so shiitake works really, really well for that kind of slow cooked sort of meat style product. Jim's working on some other mushroom-based meat alternatives. Yeah, using the kind of agaricus, the white button mushroom that's much more common in Australia. For the slow cooked meat alternative, shiitake was the best option. And again, that's kind of the benefit of one of the pluses having Jim and Chris as co-founders in the business. They've got all that, wealth of mushroom knowledge. So kind of have a good sense of which mushrooms will work for replicating different types of meats. Because ultimately we want to help contribute to ending, the worst parts of industrial animal agriculture. To do that, slow cooked meat is kind of just the start for us. We've got to want to have really good options for people to replace all the different meats in their diets.
How closely do you follow and keep an eye on Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods in the US? I saw that Starbucks recently did a deal with Impossible Foods, and I'm sure you'd be fascinated by what's going on over there. I noticed at the time of recording, the market cap of Beyond Meat is now in the vicinity of $10 billion, which, to give it some context for listeners, that's about twice the market cap of Qantas. And it is in the middle of COVID. I'm aware that Qantas has got a lot going on right now. I actually think they went into a trading halt this morning. But anyway, going back, how much do you keep an eye on what's going on overseas?
Yeah, for sure. And when I went vegetarian, I was actually living in Los Angeles and, ate lots of Impossible and Beyond Burgers. And I think they're really, really good products. A lot of my kind of market research has been, in this category, we're not the first to come out with a meat alternative. So a lot of my market research has been watching what brands like that are doing in the US market and elsewhere. I think they've done an incredibly impressive job. I think the product development is excellent. The way they've gone about building their brands is excellent. The reason for the, it's a pretty wild value market cap and valuation for Beyond, given the stage that they're at. But the reason those valuations are so high is the meat industry is 8% of global GDP. It's more than a $1 trillion industry. The theory in this category is that the consumer goes and buys meat, number one is taste and texture, very close second is price. And then, then there might be sort of health and all the other kind of reasons, but taste and texture and price are number one and number two. So when we and the other meat alternatives are thinking about the category, we try to develop products that at least match meat in terms of taste and texture. And ultimately, we want to produce products that you prefer the taste and texture over animal meat. And, Jim and our product development team, we can keep improving on the taste and texture of our products, whereas can't really keep improving on the cow. We've kind of done all of the breeding and everything that we can do for the cow. So our goal is to have a better taste and texture than animal meat. And then in terms of the price, meat's expensive to produce. Like a cow either needs a lot of land to graze on or needs to be fed in a feedlot, needs to be fed a lot of plant matter. So the average cow in a feedlot needs to eat 12 kilograms of plants to produce 1 kilogram of beef. So it's incredibly inefficient. That's why there's all the environmental issues around producing meat, but it's also costly. Our product is almost a one-to-one conversion ratio on the mushrooms and plants that we use. So as soon as we get any scale, our cost base is going to be much less than animal meat. So, and actually already in Woolworths, we're pricing at exactly the same pack size and price point as a pulled beef product that they've got in store. So, we're matching pulled beef on taste and texture, and we're matching it on price. And ultimately we want to be better on taste and texture and cheaper on price. And once we do that, there's really no reason left to eat animal meat. If we win on taste and texture and we win on price and we have all the health, environmental, ethical benefits, there's no reason to buy animal meat anymore. And once that happens in every category of meat, the theory is the whole industry will shift from animal meat to plant-based meat. And you've got 8% of global GDP, being disrupted and changing. And so businesses that are doing well in the space like Beyond Meat, that's why their market caps are so high, because the view is that they'll be a big part of that transition.
Okay, and now a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Six Park. We provide investment advice and management online to clients all over Australia. We've recently lowered the minimum investment to $5,000. So if you would like to start your own investment portfolio and looking for a level of expertise to manage it for you, then go to sixpark.com.au and take the free online risk assessment, which will ask you questions about your investment horizon, your investment experience and your appetite risk, and make an investment recommendation according to that risk profile. Your investments are all overseen by the Six Park Investment Committee, which includes Brian Watson, the former chairman of JP Morgan Australia, Lindsay Tanner, the former Minister of Finance for the Australian Government, and Mark Nicholson, who headed up an investment division of the World Bank. To find out more, including our recent returns, go to sixpark.com.au or click the link in the podcast description. Now back to my discussion with Michael.
Okay, you come up with the product, and I believe you came up with this product working out of Jim's garage, But you need investors to help so you can start producing it and getting the word out. Let's go over some of your investors that jumped on board. You've already mentioned a couple. Is Heston Blumenthal an investor?
That's a good question. And we're in the middle of talking with him about that. So he's involved in the business. We did our launch event with him at Dinner by Heston in Melbourne. He's on our packaging. And we'll conclude a deal with him pretty soon.
More to play out there. All right, from the culinary world to the tech world, Mike Cannon Brooks.
Yeah, so Mike was an investor in my last business, Shoes of Prey. So I've gotten to know Mike over the last sort of 10 or 15 years. He's got his kind of venture capital family office called Grok Ventures. And if you look at all the kinds of businesses that he invests in, you know, he's personally very passionate about climate change and sort of the environment and future of humanity. So the kinds of businesses that he invests in through his venture capital business, Grok Ventures, are all good for the world. You know, solar industry companies, future of food companies, a couple of space companies, some drone companies. We kind of fit that thesis of helping to improve the food system and making it more sustainable, as well as having personally known Mike for a long time. So it was a thrill to have him invest, co-lead our fundraising round. Yeah, together with Blackbird Ventures and Nick Crocker and Rick Baker were the sort of key people from there that invested in us too.
Yes, and I was going to mention that Blackbird Ventures, for those familiar with a previous episode where I spoke with one of the partners there, Nick Crocker, have invested. So fascinated that you've got the backing and support of a venture capital firm of the quality of Blackbird. Let's step it back a bit to when you launched December of 2019. And then a few months later, it was probably 1 month, word started to come out of China of something called COVID-19. And February, it hits. Can you tell me a bit about the early days in going from this euphoric experience of launching a business to this pandemic hitting Australia and how that affected you? But I don't want to leave you here, but the opportunity that it created for you as well.
Yeah, so it threw a pretty big, as I'm sure it did for lots of businesses, threw a spanner in the works for our strategy, because our launch strategy had been launch into food service, have the Fable brand on the menu so consumers get to try the product and meet the brand. Then we'd build an audience, and then later on we'd launch into retail with an existing audience that we can kind of send into stores to buy it, an existing audience who are looking for the product. That when restaurants started to close, that whole strategy got thrown out the window.
Like, it must have been hit you emotionally hard for so much hard work to be so many uncontrollable hurdles that you just can't overcome.
Yeah, well, to your point before about luck and the importance of luck, we'd also happened to launch with Marley Spoon, the meal kit company, in December last year. And with people starting to be at home, you know, getting food delivered to them at home, the meal kit company's sales all boomed. And so all of the revenue that we lost out of food service went straight over to Marley through Marley Spoon. Actually, our sales actually went up because Marley Spoon sales went up by so much. And it was actually, we hadn't even planned this, but it's the same experiences and it's actually even a slightly better experience than food service, because customers are getting delivered the product at Fable product at home in our Fable packaging with a recipe, and they're cooking it up themselves. And so that's like an even better way to meet the brand and get to know the product, and to build an audience. So, I mean, that was just straight up. We got kind of lucky. And then with food service too, we did a sort of a bit of a pivot in food service. So a lot of restaurants started to do, ready meals for takeaway and delivery. And so we partnered with we also wanted to help out the restaurants that we'd been working with beforehand. So we partnered with a lot of them. They did Fable ready meals. And then we did some online pop-ups where we sold their ready meals. So I live on the Sunshine Coast. We got together sort of four local restaurants. They did Fable ready meals. And we did this stay home date night hamper. So you could come onto the Fable website, $99 hamper that had two Fable ready meals. We partnered with the local brewery, so you had some beers. As a vegan cupcake company, did some desserts, and then a local pottery studio who were also kind of obviously heavily impacted by COVID, but they put in some like at-home pottery kit. So you could buy this, this kind of date night hamper, which had the Fable product in it, and yeah, made for kind of a fun date night for people. That went well, so we did that in some other states as well. And that sort of was a really good kind of brand builder for us, and helped us to engage with the community and engage with more restaurants and sort of help out some other businesses through that period. So yeah, we kind of got through that period, the COVID period, okay. Partially luck and or big part of it luck, and yeah, partially just a bit of pivoting.
Well, it shows the importance of diversifying when it comes to investing. So much of in previous episodes I've spoken about the benefits of diversifying investment portfolios, because black swan events do happen from time to time. But if you can have diversified investments or diversified client bases, distribution, whatever it be, it can help create new opportunities. So I just want to go back to Marley Spoon. So you're distributing through Marley Spoon. Sales are going really well. Can you tell us about how that led to the opportunity with Woolworths?
Yeah, so Woolworths own about, I think, roughly 15% of Marley Spoon. Marley Spoon's publicly listed. And Woolworths are a key investor. So they've got a good relationship, and they talk between each other about different products and things that are working well. And our launch with Marley Spoon had gone incredibly well. They told us sort of early this year that Fable was their best new product launch they'd ever had. And they'd rolled us out into their Dinnerly recipe boxes, which is another brand that they've got. So they shared that with Woolworths. And also I'd been talking to Woolworths even through our product development process. I'd managed to get an introduction into the buyer for the meat alternative category. And he's incredibly passionate about the category and knowledgeable. He even went plant-based himself last year to kind of live and breathe the products. And so I got talking to him last year, and he also shared some insights which helped us in our product development and actually helped encourage us to make sure we did that partnership with Heston. So that kind of made it. The combination of those things meant that once we had a retail version of the product ready, Woolworths were keen to launch it with us.
You've got you're distributed through Woolworths and direct to market in so many other different ways. Where to next?
Yeah, so I mean, going back to our mission, we want to help those flexitarian consumers reduce their meat consumption by developing a whole range of different meat alternatives. So yeah, more product development. So Jim in his garage, and that will probably need to grow soon. So doing more product development. Then obviously to help make it easy for people to reduce their meat consumption, we've got to have the product available in all the different places that consumers go and eat meat. So just a couple of weeks ago, we launched into Ribs and Burgers. They're doing a Fable beef brisket burger in Queensland. I think next week we launch with Miss India. They're a 27-store Indian restaurant chain. We're in Burger Urge in Queensland. And then we're in discussions with a lot of the other QSR chains as well. So we want to have the Fable product available in all those places where people are eating. And then similarly in retail, we're in 600 Woolworths stores, so it's about two-thirds of their store network. But yeah, we want to kind of make sure we're building up the sales so we can roll out into more stores and have the product available in more places in Australia. And then that's the Australian market. We're starting to dip our toe into markets in Singapore and the UK. So the partnership with Heston really helps us, particularly in the UK market. So we're talking to some retailers and QSR chains over there. We've got a distributor starting to distribute the product into restaurants and retail in Singapore. And we'll stay pretty focused this calendar year on the Australian market, because we really want to make sure we nail down the value proposition and that we're focused on getting feedback from consumers and continuing to improve the product before we start to go too wide and into too many markets. But yeah, we'll dip our toe in the water in Singapore and the UK, and then yeah, potentially sort of ramp up into international markets next year.
You mentioned all the places people eat meat, and I was thinking, where is the ultimate goal where I know you've got the mass market, and it is the day I go to a Bunnings and I go to get my sausage and bread, yeah, and I see some fable as an option along with the onion, that I go, all right, you've won us over.
That's a good one. You've just upped that. That's a long way down on our priority list, but you've just upped it, Ted, because that's awesome. I'd love that too.
I don't know what the margin is on a $2 sausage, but so it might be better fishing elsewhere. Michael, where can listeners find out more information on you and Fable?
Yeah, so the social media channel that we're probably most active on as a brand is Instagram. So we're at Fable Food Co. on Instagram. Our website is fablefood.co. So those are probably the two best places to connect as a brand. And then me personally, I'm on reasonably active on Twitter. Michael Fox with 3 M's at the start is my handle there. And then LinkedIn is a good spot to connect with me too.
All right. Make sure you go out and buy some Fable. And if you're new to the show, make sure you subscribe and tell a friend. Michael, thank you so much for the chat today.
Thanks so much for having me, Ted. Really good to speak with you. Cheers.
No worries. See you next time on The Richards Report.